There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
So after numerous books on the beauty and intricacy of the human body, Human Errors is the book that we're talking about by Nathan H. Lentz. It's the book that is here to celebrate the beauty of our flaws at the hands of evolution. For our mutations are, in their own way, a testament to our species' greatness, he says. So today's big question is simply, how flawed are we as a species?
The big question.
Joining us today to chat to us about this book is Jonathan Siklos. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be here in your fantastic new studios.
So tell us a little bit about Human Errors before we get started. We've got the main idea, but, you know, tell us about the reading of it, whether it's enjoyable, who you'd recommend it to, and a little bit about the author as well.
Okay, so as you say, the book is effectively a counterpoint to all the stories and studies there are about the wonder of the human body, the marvel of its engineering, the perfection of its design. The book looks at the imperfections that we are beset by. So the stump of pointless vertebrae at the end of our spines, which is our vestigial tail, the fact that we have too many bones in our wrists and ankles, our brains, which are irrational and play tricks on us, and an abysmal reproductive system, which means that many of us can't reproduce safely or at all without the intervention of modern medicine.
See, on the surface, it's slightly depressing reading about all this. But I actually found when I was reading the book that, oh, there's a reason why I'm not okay all the time.
I didn't find it at all depressing. I quite loved it. I find more depressing this idea that we just develop steadily, boringly, and all. I like this sort of bonkersness of the things in the human body. I loved it.
I found it uplifting as well. Yeah. I think the counter is more depressing. The idea that we are a product of perfection when probably none of us really feel like that most of the time.
And the excuses it gives you for things.
Exactly.
It gave all these excuses about why we put on weight. And I just thought, I love this book. Mm. It's not my fault at all.
Why I can't come to work tomorrow? Well, actually, it's my needy diet and the fact that I have too many bones in my ankle.
Well, you can try that one, see how it fares, and let us know on 4001, the text line, if you would like to join in the conversation. So Jonathan and I were lucky enough to speak to Nathan when he was in New York over the phone about Human Errors. And what we first wanted to know was, you know, why focus on our flaws, say, rather than the bits we get right? And he mentioned the need to push back on two particular misconceptions about evolution.
One of them is the notion that evolution produces perfection, and that adaptation is so sublime that everything is perfectly adapted to its environment. And that's a really big misconception, because actually there's no such thing as perfection in nature. There's really nothing even close to perfection in nature. Evolution is all about compromises and doing the best you can, and just barely surviving in many cases. So we really should not expect to see perfection. But that's a holdover from this idea of a perfect world and perfect creatures. The second misconception that I think holds a lot of us back is this idea that humans are exceptional, that we are just altogether different kind of creatures than everything else on the planet. And that's also not true, especially if you ignore for a moment our cognitive abilities. We really are just another mammal, just another primate. And we have many of the same shortcomings and limitations that the other animals have. And in fact, I argue in the book that we're probably more flawed than most animals. We have a lot more imperfection because we have these big brains. Our bodies are less than. So those are the two misconceptions that I'm pushing back against: human exceptionalism and perfection, expecting to see perfection in nature, because both of those really do hold back our ability to understand our place in the world and history and in nature.
Biologist Nathan H. Lentz there about the two misconceptions about evolution: the perfection in nature and human exceptionalism. See, that's a difficult word to say on a Saturday.
Exceptionalism in pronunciation.
Exactly. So now moving on to actually look at some of the imperfections. Would you mind letting us know which ones you thought were the most remarkable, and also like how it's set up in terms of the book structure.
So as well as talking about our physical imperfections, the book is set out in a number of chapters which discuss different ways in which we could be better. So to take a few of them, he goes through our needy diet. And when you think about it, we do have an incredibly needy diet compared with other animals. We're almost unique among animals in that we require a range of different vitamins, so A, C, B12, D. And if we don't get those vitamins, we will eventually die. We will succumb to unpleasant things. We need a range of metals, which may sound peculiar, but we do need trace amounts of sodium, potassium, calcium, zinc also to survive. And if we don't get those things, again, we will die.
We'll get scurvy.
All these things scurvy, end with we will
exactly,
die.
Lack of vitamin C. Amino acids. If we don't get amino acids, what will happen?
We will die.
Exactly. Exactly. And when you look at other animals, if you look at what a cow eats all day, it eats grass all day, nothing but grass. What do you feed your pet cat? A sort of disgusting mixture of meat and rice, but that's all they get. That's all they get. That's all they eat.
I've never given my dogs kale in any shape or form.
Exactly.
And I don't think that they would eat it either.
My mum gives her cat all sorts of weird things out on the lawn. And so far it hasn't
died. You should gift her this yes. book, Rachel.
But we're not just being fussy. We really, really need those things. And the reason is that we can't synthesize them. We used to be able to, thousands, even millions of years ago. But then a more varied diet became available to us. We took advantage of it. And eventually we lost the ability to synthesize these vitamins, these amino acids and these metals, which most other animals can do.
Foolish us.
That is really interesting. So there's imperfections in terms of our diet. But one of the things that I found really interesting was how even internally, we are born with like strands of genes that are just broken. There's a description I really enjoyed that there's a few key parts of your genetic code that's already mutated. Mm-hmm. And he says, it's as if you remove the spark plug from a car. It's still a car. You can easily see that it's still a car. In fact, you would have to look very carefully to find anything wrong with it at all. But it cannot function as a car, not even slightly. It's totally inoperable, even though most of it is still exactly the same way it was before it was broken. And he's talking there about a specific gene that causes a random mutation.
It's funny, isn't it?
It is.
The different bits that appeal to you as a reader. Because the one that really stood out to me was the sort of mucus drainage system, as someone who gets loads of cough.
Lovely.
And I thought it was so fascinating. The fact that we have to drain things upwards rather than downwards. So we're going against gravity. Mm-hmm. And I love that fact that humans get 200 times more colds than dogs, simply because of that one tiny biological fact.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a lot of what the book does is to put the way things work in our body in the context of modern engineering. Yeah. And so we have nasal sinuses which drain upwards or need to drain upwards. The holes for them to drain are in the top of the cavities. And that's obviously a poor design is the reason why we get, according to the book, 2 to 5 colds a year, which for anyone who has young children is an absolute nonsense. I get about 10 times that amount. But the going back to the genome, there are vast expanses of our DNA that don't perform any detectable function. And not only that, there are mistakes in our DNA, which is supposedly set up to copy itself perfectly. And these mistakes lead to things like sickle cell disease and Huntington's. And there are other good reasons why these diseases, which obviously are unpleasant things that we would all want to avoid, confer evolutionary advantages, which mean that they haven't died out.
It's a catch-22 situation in a lot of these cases, isn't it? So we've established that we're less than perfect, but we also, I remember we asked Nathan if there is such thing as a perfect creature. Should we really feel that bad? Are we the only ones?
No, absolutely not. Because think about it. Just do a very quick thought experiment. If you could imagine a creature that was always successful finding food, evaded every predator, defeated every infectious disease, then that population would expand and explode so quick that we would immediately be out of food and have eaten everything around it to the point where now the entire species is starving to death. So you could only be perfectly adapted for maybe half of a generation, and then that would be it. And you would take all the other life down with you. So no, evolution is a constant struggle for survival. And in fact, actually, one of Darwin's very big insights in the mid-19th century was that every species he looked at overproduced offspring. So, you know, two birds would come together and they would raise a clutch of, say, 8 hatchlings. Well, if you can imagine two birds creating eight every generation, then you would expect that population to be expanding rapidly. But it wasn't. Most populations are fairly stable over time. And that means most individuals don't succeed. And that was Darwin's really big insight, is that all of the species on the planet are locked in a struggle for survival, and most individuals don't succeed. Now, we've largely escaped that recently, the natural selection part of it. But we didn't until very recently. And so we have the marks of most of our members of our species until recently were not successful and would not have lived to reproductive age. And that's true. I mean, think about an oak tree. It drops 1,000 acorns every year. Clearly, they don't all end up as oak trees. So that's really the story of nature, is that we overproduce offspring and we set up a struggle for survival.
So Nathan H. Lentz there on, is there such a thing as a perfect creature? In short, no, because if there were, it would rule the planet, eat everything, and we'd notice. Anything else that you'd like to mention? We've got about 1 minute left, Jonathan.
I thought he was going to say sharks then, by the way. That's kind of what I was angling for.
Really?
But I suppose it makes perfect sense that if sharks were better than they are, then they would have eaten everything and there'd be nothing left. They'd be very fat. They'd
and
be sitting
the
on their,
jaws
on their
be
sofas
very
watching. But no, one of the other things that I found interesting was allergies. And allergies are quite a hot topic now. And one of the things that is mentioned in the book is that when the author, who maddeningly is only in his late 30s, was at school, he didn't know anyone who had an allergy, or there was one person in his year. But now, with his children, there are many schools which have gone nut-free, and allergies are very, very common indeed. And there is no good reason for this, or at least there is a reason for it, but it is not beneficial from an evolutionary perspective that we are becoming allergic to things, and sometimes drastically so, life-threateningly so.
That is very interesting.
The big question.
So, before we went away for a couple of minutes, we were talking about the things that we are not very good at from an evolutionary perspective. We talked about allergies. And we asked Nathan, of all the things that he's written about in the book, from diet to reproduction to the way our brains work, what's most imperfect about us?
Especially acute. Different imperfections would be especially problematic in different environments. And so what is now, I think, a very big imperfection, which is our ability to extract nutrients from food, that I think it can be very limiting in a lot of different areas where human beings exist now. And so vitamin deficiencies and malnutrition has caused the death of many humans over the course of time. However, during the time when we were evolving in sub-Saharan Africa in the rich, lush rainforest, it wasn't a problem. So it didn't. And in fact, that's probably why we have such a crazy demanding diet, is that we were used to being served up all this nutritious food right in front of us. And we didn't have to struggle to find all these vitamins. And so if you think about it, that became an imperfection. And so it just depends on what you're surrounded by. And then right now, our inability to reproduce as effectively as other creatures certainly does not seem like an imperfection, because there's already plenty of us on this planet. We don't need to make more. But if we had a very, very small population size, as certainly happened in our past, then that inability to reproduce quickly and successfully would have been a real threat to our survival. So it just depends on the environment. It's hard to say which imperfection is any worse than any other, because that will just change based on conditions on the ground. But that really is the story of evolution, and is that the conditions are constantly changing. There is nothing close to a static environment from generation to generation, even from year to year sometimes. And our ability to survive and thrive is based on our ability to adapt and roll with the changes and be broadly successful. And it's been a good strategy, but it does lead us with all these little quirks that have come from evolution's blind spot over the years.
So what's most imperfect about us? Not easy to answer. In short, it depends, according to Nathan Lentz, and it depends on the environment and all sorts of other factors. He mentioned the word quirks there, and I think when we're reading the book, that is a word that definitely pops into our minds. Some of the things that are wrong with us, some of the design flaws are really quite serious, especially on the scale of gene mutation. There's a whole section that's entirely about cancer. But then there's some very quirky parts of the book as well, things that don't really occur to us when we think of things that are wrong with us, but which actually are. What were your favourite parts of the book, Rachel?
I particularly liked the bits about why our brains work as they do and how it can lead us into trouble, because it kind of gives an explanation, particularly like in young teenagers when they're all going, look at this really stupid thing I can
do. Oh,
yes. We're kind of genetically, especially males apparently, are genetically wired to be moronic at certain points in life.
Yeah, that apparently confers an evolutionary advantage, being stupid, taking risks when you're younger. And the one that really struck me in that chapter was smoking. So smoking can confer an evolutionary benefit because you're effectively saying, look at me, I'm smoking,
so strong,
I am so healthy. Exactly. I'm that healthy that I can smoke cigarettes and it's not going to harm me. And not only does that confer an evolutionary advantage, so it makes predominantly young males attractive to the opposite sex, but it also helps them to build bonds with other males.
Yes, who think I want to be strong.
Yeah,
it's I'll be in his gang.
It's peacocking. It's doing exactly what peacocks do. And it's fascinating to read that we are all, as creatures, exactly the same, hardwired to do exactly the same things.
Yeah, that was my bit that I just thought, I love this. This is interesting. And like I say, this idea that we are, again, hardwired, because throughout kind of history, we've been on the verge of starvation. And that's how other species are managing to not get quite as obese as humans.
Yeah.
And I just love that. So there's an inbuilt excuse. It's genetic. We can't help putting on weight.
Yeah, the problem of obesity is commonly thought of as a problem of sedentary lifestyles, of modern lifestyles, of the fact that we're sitting and not moving around, not having to hunt, not having to work. But according to Nathan Lentz, it's because we are hardwired to be unsatisfied if our stomachs aren't completely full. So we haven't evolved to be be hungry.
Yes.
Exactly. We can't do it. We can't not be hungry.
And
so we eat.
Yeah.
So that's the excuse you're going to give every time I get off for
every
you
cake.
Every
time anyone asks if I'm on a diet or nope, I'm hardwired.
Yeah, it's
to
in
eat
my
more
DNA.
Cake. Sorry.
I was born this way. The one that the one that struck me was breathing. We could be breathing better.
We could be breathing better.
A lot better. Yeah. So I think so. Anyone who studied biology at school remembers how it works. Okay. So you breathe in through the nose or the mouth, and the air goes down through the trachea and into the lungs, and then in the alveoli, it sort of moves across a membrane. The oxygen moves across a membrane, and carbon dioxide is moved back, and that is expelled in the opposite direction. This is called tidal breathing because the air comes in and the air goes out. The problem is this is a really inefficient system. And the mix of carbon dioxide and oxygen means that we could be doing this a lot better if we had one-way traffic like fishes do. So fishes get enough oxygen from the water, which we obviously can't do. And the reason they're able to do that is because the water, which is oxygenated, passes through their system, not in and out.
We need gills.
We need gills.
Yes. Wait,
I've always wanted gills.
I'd quite like gills.
So we've talked quite a bit about things that we're not very good at. And I think I'm starting to feel a little bit sorry for myself here. So we did ask Nathan, what are we most brilliant at to kind of, pick ourselves back up again?
So I have to answer this in two ways. Let's talk about the body and then we'll talk about the mind. So if you talk about the body, the one thing that humans are great at is being a generalist. So in fact, we're sometimes called the generalist specialist in the sense that our specialty is to be good at lots of different things. And so chimpanzees are much stronger than us, all right? But we're taller than they are. And just that's the story with us, is that we are very good at doing lots of different things. But at any one thing, we're not better than any other animal, so to speak. So we adapt to be these broad generalists. And that's true in our mind, but it's also true in our body. So our body is very robust. We can live in lots of different climates, from rainforests to deserts to plains to mountains even. So we're very good at being generalists and being adaptable, even among individuals. The other thing I think where we really sets us apart, which will come as a surprise to no one, is that we have very powerful brains. We have cognitive capacities that far exceeds other animals. And this is where I sort of start to contradict myself when I say, when I have to admit that we really are different in some of these cognitive ways than other animals. Other animals don't write books, for example. And so that makes us very special. But whether or not that is our biggest strength, I think is still up for debate, because we might very well be on the precipice of taking our own species down. The catastrophes that are possible right now are all problems of our own making. And so it's hard to say. Our big brains seem like it's the best thing about us, but what if we What if we're responsible for a nuclear holocaust that destroys, that takes our species down? It's hard to see our big brains as anything but a flaw if that's what it leads us to do. So I'm not so sure. I think the jury's still out on whether our big, powerful brains are our best feature or our biggest flaw.
Nathan Lentz there on where we are most brilliant or remarkable. I think basically saying that we're a jack of all trades or a Swiss Army kind of creature more than anything. I know that you particularly like the Olympic analogy.
Yeah, he made this analogy. He said that if we participated in the Olympic Games, that sort of contest that included all the species on Earth, we wouldn't win any single contest, but we might do all right in the decathlon because we kind of can come in sort of close second on a few of them. I like that idea.
I'd be all right with that.
Be nice. Or chess, he said. If there was chess as an Olympic sport, humans would be okay because of the big brains.
But we would still be beaten by computers.
Yes, but they're not really a species yet.
Yet.
I found the idea of natural selection and the fact that it may or may not still be continuing in humans to be fascinating. That's one of the themes of the book, is whether or not we are still subject to natural selection. Because perhaps since we have evolved medicine and we've evolved modern lifestyles, and we can perpetuate our lives and perhaps in the future perpetuate them indefinitely, perhaps we have short-circuited natural selection. And that is supposedly a debate that's going on in science at the moment.
On the ominous note, maybe we're entering natural deselection. So in the way that we now have lost the ability to synthesize certain foods and we're now allergic, maybe the humans have peaked and now we're going downhill fast.
Yeah.
That's a cheery note.
Yeah.
And then they die.
Yeah. Well, he also says that our big brains may be, you know, although that seems that is what has conferred our superior evolutionary advantage, that may now be what becomes our downfall.
I think that's what I find particularly interesting, the whole chapter on how our brains work and then how he's talking about what that means for the future, that we are our own worst enemy. Our greatest strength is also potentially our greatest weakness as well. And I find that whole balancing act very interesting.
Slightly doom-laden.
Yes, but we're a cheery bunch on this show, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes to talk about some other fun quirks that we encountered along the way when we were reading Human Errors. I know you've got quite a few there, Jonathan. Do you want to share some more?
I enjoyed the section on the brain and all the ways that it goes wrong. I think this really, it struck a chord with me. I think I realised that I was subject to, I mean, because it's hard to feel like you've got too many bones in your wrist or your ankle, and it's hard to, I mean, you may appreciate the fact that the forearm with its two bones could have been designed better. It's hard to really recognize that it's a shortcoming in yourself, whereas the section on the brain covered how susceptible we are to optical illusions, for example, and how we're so highly attuned to human faces that we see human faces where there are no human faces. I mean, this is often something that appears in the news. There's a tomato that's been sliced in two and there's a face appearing there, or in the bark of a tree, and people get very excited about them.
A potato that looks like Churchill.
Yeah, no, that did look like Churchill. But I mean, we are because of the way we've evolved, because human faces are effectively all very similar, but we can see the differences in them. We're highly attuned to them, and one of the downfalls of this is that we see human faces where there are no human faces.
That's very interesting.
It is interesting.
We've also, I mean, there are a number of cognitive biases that we've evolved as well, and they're our way of making sense of the world. But we are susceptible to a number of them, such as confirmation bias, which basically means that it's very difficult to change our mind, particularly with any issues to do with politics or sociology. We have our opinions, they're formed, and then we will hold on to them in the face of almost insurmountable evidence to the contrary.
He also talks about eyewitness accounts and testimonies in law court situations as well. And that whole thing was fascinating, but also absolutely terrifying, because he basically goes on to say that that people see what they want to see, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the idea of false memories often being clearer or stronger than your actual memories.
Yep, that's absolutely right. I think in criminal trials, eyewitness testimony used to be absolutely guilt-edged. If you had a reliable witness and they had seen what had happened, then that used to be the matter closed. But forensic psychologists have demonstrated that people make up memories, they put themselves in the first person where they weren't in the first person, where they were a bystander, and they get things wrong, even things that they've seen. And memories change over time. I mean, my first memory, I've always said, was from when I was 2 years old and we got our first cat, our family cat. And I remember driving home with it and the cat was asleep on the palm of my mum's hand in the car. And I remember her showing it to me. But now I'm just not sure that's possible. I'm not sure you can have, at the ripe age of 37, a memory from 35 years ago.
It's interesting, isn't it? Dum, dum, dum. I find the face thing interesting. I think you do. You read these things and you put your own personal perspective on, don't you? Because my son, when he was younger, was diagnosed with a kind of face blindness. And it's always been an issue for him. And as I was reading this, I found it really interesting. Because when he was very small, in the way other babies look at faces, and so they therefore develop this pattern that he talks about, that you see faces everywhere. He wouldn't look at people. He would look at things and he would look at screens. And he would, you know, he had no interest in faces. And I wonder, you know, that sort of chicken and egg thing. Was that because he didn't recognise them, or has that come as a result of not looking and developing the pattern?
That's called prosopagnosia, isn't it? Yeah. And there's I think, a quite a high proportion of people that suffer from that, more than you'd think, but the people who suffer from it mildly develop ways around it.
Ways of coping,
They look for voices and items of jewellery and they can work their way around it. But there's a small percentage of people who literally can't recognise people.
All my son's friends were always extremely tall or wide or particular colour hair. It was interesting.
The big question.
It's hard to say, but I think if that really is the fate that we're going to experience and that all civilizations do, I would say it's probably in the next couple of generations, because that's when the carrying capacity of the planet will be exceeded, meaning there'll be more humans than the planet can sustain. And that's during times of widespread strife is when populations are definitely at their worst, so to speak, in terms of making decisions that are in the common good. And so when resources become limiting, that's when you're going to see wars, and the stakes are so much higher now because of technology and you know, weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera. So my thought, because also the precipice here is our ability to leave the planet successfully and set up life somewhere else. So if we get to that point, I think it changes the ballgame. But if we don't, you know, we either have to limit population growth and start really living in a sustainable way, because we are nowhere near living in a sustainable way in terms of our energy resources, in terms of food, in all kinds of ways, we are not on a trajectory now for sustainability. So it has to come to a head at some point, either by our change or by a catastrophe. And so I would say it's within a couple of generations. There are people alive today that are being born today that will probably hold the answer, like they'll get to see the answer, whatever the answer is. I think within 80 to 100 years, we'll know if we're destined for catastrophe or not.
So we are, of course, talking about human errors, a panorama of our glitches from pointless bones to broken genes by biologist Nathan H. Lent. And that was Nathan there answering this very doomsday question: how long have we got? And basically what he's saying there is that we'll find out if we're doomed in the next couple of generations, which is quite very soon in evolutionary terms. And there are people alive today, he says, who will get to know the answer to that. And it could go either way, really, couldn't it?
It
can go either way.
I like his answer. I don't know, so we'll find out when everybody is doomed, that they were doomed.
Quite a depressing thought that our civilization is going to implode due to our own consumption of non-renewable food and fuel, and our inability to make more of it, and our inability to make a home elsewhere. And one of the arguments that he gave in support of this position is that he believes, and other scientists believe, that it is likely that there has been alien life elsewhere in the universe, but that just not at the same time. The universe is 14 billion years old, and human beings are 150,000 years old. And the way he tells it, we're not going to live many more thousands of years. And so his hypothesis and the hypothesis of other people is that there has been alien life and they should have been able to contact us, but they just weren't around at the same time.
We missed out on the aliens.
We missed out on the aliens.
That's such a depressing thought. But then maybe there will be more in the future.
Oh, gosh, it's like sliding doors, but with
billions of years.
Yeah.
I'm not really into the doom thing. I think that because of this enormous brain we've evolved to have, people will find a solution. I think until there's a problem to find a solution for, there's no solution. But once you put people in a tricky situation, their biggest brains will put themselves to thinking about it. Because you often, like the news stories, you remember the kids that were trapped in the cave, oh, it's impossible to rescue them. As soon as people have that problem, they find a way to rescue them. And I think we are like a giant version of the cave, and future big brains will find a way to rescue us from doom.
Well, here's a big question for you then, listeners. What do you think is going to be the fate of humanity? Is it a positive one or a negative one? Text is on 4001. I'm hoping for an equal balance of optimists and pessimists. So we also asked Nathan if he could fix one of the flaws of our strongest asset, our brain. Since you were just talking about brains there, Rachel, what would it be? This is what he had to say.
Yes, I, as a scientist especially, I think the biggest glitch in our brain is our reliance on stories and anecdotes over data and evidence. And so we have, because of our social history as a species, we really believe stories and narratives and anecdotes much more than we do large collections of data. And it's because we can emotionally connect with a story, and we can't emotionally connect with a data set. But that leads us to make profound mistakes in our public policy, in our long-term planning, in just how we live our daily lives even. If we were much more willing to learn from big data sets and also open to changing our mind, that's a separate flaw, but if there's a data set that has 1,000 anecdotes in it, it should be 1,000 times more powerful for us than a single anecdote, but it's not. We actually ignore data all the time in favor of a little story we heard from someone, and I think that's a big flaw for us because it holds us back from making good choices. And related to that in the mind, I think, is our inability to change our mind in the face of new evidence. So we become very committed to beliefs that we hold, even when it's just really not sustainable based on the evidence. And that again, speaks to our past, our evolutionary past, because strong individuals, for whatever reason in our species, are not seen as changing their mind. And changing your mind, for some reason, is seen as a weakness, is seen as flip-flopping, is seen as being wishy-washy. But actually, that's the smartest thing you can do, is gather evidence and say, you know what, I don't believe that anymore. I now believe this because this is what the evidence leads me to. Why is that seen as a weakness? I mean, our politicians, that's the one thing you can never say as a politician. Like, you know what, I was wrong about that. they just resist that every chance they get. And we reward them. I mean, politics just reflects who we are. It's not a unique problem for politicians. They're actually just mirroring back to us our own flaws. So I think those are the two that really hold us back, at least at this current historical moment.
So there you go. That's Nathan there on, if you could fix one of the flaws of our strongest asset, our brain, what would it be? And he says reliance on anecdotal evidence, basically, and the refusal that we have to change our minds.
I think everything that he says is extremely wise, and I have listened nodding my head. But for the first time during that answer, I was a little bit because I actually really think that the focus on stories is what makes humans humans, the kind of imagination, yes, the creativity, and it's what brings joy.
I thought you might bring this up.
Well, but partly because I've had sort of two halves in my career. I used to be a planner in advertising, and there was a lot of number crunching and quantitative data and all that kind of stuff. And I can see how it would make things more accurate, but it makes life slightly sucked of joy and it's far less interesting. So I don't want to evolve so we like stories less and we like data more, because that would be dull.
But he is right though, isn't he? I mean, you must...
He is correct if you that want to convince... life would be more accurate if we believe data rather than anecdote.
But even people, I mean, you must have seen this in your previous professional existence, that even when you're presenting statistics and numbers, it goes down better if you tell a story.
Absolutely. And people will reject facts. So if you... We had to do something, it was a study on fighting racism. And if you gave people facts, then their entrenched racism became stronger because they felt you were attacking them. If you told them a story and introduced an individual, then their barriers would break down and they would listen more. Mm-hmm. So I think he's absolutely right. And I think that perhaps that shouldn't be how we argue, but I think people are happier with a world full of stories.
Ignorance is bliss.
Ignorance is bliss. I'm all for blissful ignorance.
We have a very short period of time left to continue the discussion. So I'm just going to ask Jonathan to tell us a surprising fun fact that I did not spot when I first read the book.
Fun fact is that Nathan Lentz is a big fan of Napoleon Dynamite, the cult film from about 12 or 15 years ago. And there is at least one reference in the book that I noticed that Nathan Lentz has made to Napoleon Dynamite. So those of you that have it, look out for it.
And you're not going to tell them what it is?
Certainly not.
No, they have to find it for themselves. Okay, I was going to be nice and tell them exactly where it was, but no, we're not going to do that, apparently. We're being mean and gloomy on Talking
Books. You can tell me later.
Yes. So, just to finish up, who would you recommend this book to?
That's an easy question. Anyone who's curious, anyone who is interested. Anyone who's interested. It's such an easy book to read, and it's such an interesting book. I can't think of anyone that wouldn't enjoy it.
I'd agree, actually. Yeah. It's incredibly easy to absorb, but you're absorbing really interesting and important information.
The thing that I noticed about it was I learned more about what works and how my body works in general by reading about what doesn't work than I did at school.
And it was, I mean, I read it a couple of times and I noticed different things the second time. And it's easy. It's fun. It's well written. It's written in this slightly sort of folksy conversational style, which can be somewhat irritating at times.
What I like in a non-fiction book, because you invest your time in reading it, is things that give you stories or kind of facts to tell people.
Like dinner party conversation. Mm-hmm.
And you get a lot out of these. I've already told hundreds of people that we have colds 200 times more than dogs. And there are many more bits that I like.
Well, that's about all we have time for when talking about Human Errors by Nathan H. Lentz. Thank you so much to Jonathan for coming in and reviewing the book for us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.